You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everyone. Hopefully everybody's doing well. It's been pretty rainy in my area. I was on the road this past week. I am on the road again next week, just working. Good weekend for me. I'm going to be playing trees, a bunch of willows. I've got some trees from Blue Hill Nursery from Ryan Haynes. He's been on the podcast. So I've got some crabapple trees going in, some persimmon trees. Great time to be planting trees this time of year. If you're not out planting trees, hopefully you're turkey hunting, you're doing something productive, you're enjoying yourself, or you're building habitat. I just had a client tonight. I went out to dinner with one of my clients. I worked with him a couple years ago, and he brought up a bunch of material from his particular area that I need for a project. So really appreciate, you know, him, and I know he listens to the podcast, and you know, really appreciate him supporting me. A lot of people have been supporting me lately. I actually have a trip with a client on Sunday. We're picking up some equipment in a different area. So I've just been really fortunate to make some great connections, and I'm just fortunate in general. And I just, you know, hopefully, you know, this good fortune continues on, and those that are around me, obviously, you know, also our fortune as well. I've just been very lucky over the past, I would say, a few months. Some good things have happened, good opportunities have happened to me for my business. And, you know, I just feel very, very fortunate and lucky. All right, I've got a returning guest. Travis Harmon is back from Creative Habitat LLC. He's been on here before. Great guy. A lot of knowledge, a lot of information. So we're going to pull that from him today and learn what he's been working on. He bought a new piece of property. So we're going to learn a little about his property and some of the things he's been running into, and ideas and improvements and concepts that he's working on his own personal journey. So let me get him on the line. Travis, how are you doing?
John Teeter, I'm doing real good.
Good. Let's check in with you on your property, but I have a fundamental question for you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a project that I'm working on my property. So in my yard, I'm kind of relaying out my property in my own personal. I own 5 acres here at the house, and I'm putting in a pollinator mix. It's a mix that I came up with. And currently it's got a layer of sod that's been mowed. It's 2 to 3 inches tall. And beneath that is gravelly, loamy soil. The grass that's present in the yard is crabgrass, perennial ryegrass, and Kentucky bluegrass. Those are the three grasses that are on the property. I need to figure out how to include this pollinator planting with the least amount of disturbance. You know, again, the sod layer is, you know, not very deep, and there's not a lot of organic material in the layer below that, in the gravelly, loamy soil. So there's a lot of gravel intermixed in there. How would you approach that from introducing, you know, a new species of plants, forbs, in that particular area? What would be your tactic? No herbicide apply. There's been no preparatory work occurring other than a little bit of mowing. How would you approach that particular topic?
Hey, yeah, it sounds like you're in a pretty good position. We're still real early in the year, so I think if you're starting out on something fresh, you're in a good spot. The first thing I would do is probably go back and listen to the two podcasts that we did prior. I think that I covered quite a few details on how to go about establishing wildflowers and pollinator habitat in your particular situation, what you're approaching. I would definitely let that green up. You know, you need to get into the growth mode to where herbicides are going to be effective. And so you want to let, you know, temperatures start hitting above 60 degrees with some consistency. Let those grasses green up some. And then I would get in there and I would start killing it. Herbicide application, even though, you know, there may not be some broadleafs there, but I would definitely come at it with some glyphosate and then a 2,4-D mix. And I'd burn it down. And as long as there wasn't a lot of grass present, I wouldn't necessarily use fire. I would leave that organic material there as a mulch later. I wouldn't even think about disturbing the soil at all. No tilling or anything like that. I would let the area rest for probably several weeks. And depending on frequency of moisture, I'd be waiting to see what resprouts. And so, you know, once you kill it off, there should be some spring back of some residual seeds that are going to get exposed because the grass has been killed and whatnot. You're going to let that come back and kind of judge the thickness of the germination. Did you have a lot of regrowth or is it kind of spotty? But you're definitely going to kill it off again. You know, that first initial germination, you want to wait till that gets, you know, 1 to 2 inches tall. You're probably looking at a few weeks. Go ahead and burn it down again. And if it was thick with a lot of weeds and grass came back, I would go ahead and do that cycle over again. And so you're almost into a third kill. But if it wasn't too bad, I might go ahead and take a gamble and throw some seed at it. I'd probably, you know, come in and do a broadcast, mix in the seed. I think I covered details in the other podcast on applications. And I would try to put the seed down prior to a good rain, you know, a long period of moisture. I might use something to try to work the seed in lightly, maybe a harrow or a landscape rake, or I guess it depends on the soil. The soil you was describing, I don't think you're going to have to work it much. Most of this wildflower seed wants to be in that top eighth inch layer of soil. And if you have some of that grass dead material on top, that's going to create some additional mulch that's going to hold moisture for you. And so I just try to limit the disturbance and then, you know, the frequency of rain again, and I would wait and see what happens. Now, understanding your seed mix is key. You know, there's going to be hopefully some quick germinating annuals, that should start kicking off germination in 7 to 10 days. And those particular varieties are going to give you a gauge quickly on, you know, did you get some seed to take your distribution, based on just a few varieties in the mix that you put down. And then you can make a judgment at that time. There should also, you're going to have maybe some weeds come in with your flowers, but you can make somewhat of a judgment if you can handle it or not, or if it's too bad. If the weeds come in too heavy, then you need to kill it all again and reseed. Now, it might be tough to bite the bullet there, but for these plantings, you're trying to set yourself up for years of success. And so, you know, if you got to throw a little bit more seed at it by reseeding it, it's not like you put a lot of work into the initial seeding if you're no-tilling. It was just time and a little bit of money for the seed. But in the long run, it will produce a much better planting that 2 or 3 years down the road is going to be in a lot better shape. But if it is manageable, then you're just going to, you know, you might have to fix some small areas, kill off small spots if weeds are too thick in particular areas. Being able to identify problems early is going to be critical. So being able to ID certain plants when they're young, that'll tell you if you've got a problem. And so there's great apps out there to help people do that. myself, with years of experience of doing this, I'm able to identify those early, so it really helps you take care of the problem early. But don't be afraid. For you, I think you're targeting probably like a June timing for seeding, because you need to go through 6 to 8 weeks, probably at minimum, seed bed preparation before you think about putting your seed, at least attempting to try your seed. And that's a great time to seed, actually. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite times to seed is in June, late June into early July. I think that's a prime time to put in wildflowers. You know, one thing about natives and, you know, native seeds and wildflowers, look at the way nature is doing it. You know, when is nature dropping those seeds in? Now, when you're doing a one-time shot and you're trying to put a mix down, and a lot of the mixes that we offer, you're talking 41 varieties. It's not, whenever you plant, it's not going to be prime time for every single variety. But you're kind of picking a happy medium. That's why I like June and July. It's kind of in that, you know, that medium zone.
No, that's excellent and great information. I appreciate you walking me through that, because I know that people either are doing this, you know, in around food plots, right? They're doing it in their yards. I think it's important to have, you know, that type of understanding and knowledge and experience. And, you know, fortunately, I have a no-till drill, so I can use that as a means to, you know, using it's just a quicker resource for me, and at least keeps my seeding rate more consistent. All right, I got another.
Yeah, hey, let's touch on that real quick, because I think it brings up something real interesting about the drill.
Good.
So I covered it a little bit, how I apply seed in the past, but here locally, I've never seen a planting done that looks like what I'm doing produced by a drill. I'm 100% broadcast. I don't think it's possible to produce it with a drill. But a company here locally had somebody else come in and plant wildflowers last fall. And they drilled it in. I didn't quote the job. They didn't call me. But they put a sign out front saying they were establishing a pollinator habitat. And it's a fairly sizable size area. So I got to see, I drive by there every day on my way to my day job. I got to see how they installed that planting, and they definitely used a drill to do it. But I'm very anxious this spring. They seeded it last fall, did it differently than I would have approached it. And I'm very curious to see this spring how it turns out compared to how I would have approached it. And if your listeners follow any of my social media, you know, they see what my style of planting will produce.
Right.
So, you know, this was another company. I don't even know who seeded it for them. But I can't wait to find out. We're a little early yet to see what it's going to look like. But it's already starting to show some signs. And I can't wait to be able to judge it, to be honest with you.
Well, let's just talk quickly about some of the differences. What do you think from an implementation standpoint was different? Maybe your questioning in process.
So definitely, I think I would have not seeded it when they seeded it at all. They seeded it late, probably November, I would say. And for a fall seeding in that size of an area, I would have, if it was November when I was going to get the contract, I wouldn't even have seeded it yet. I would have done some prep work last fall. I would have continued prep work this spring. And then I would have probably done like a May, late May type seeding. I can already see the growth coming in. Some of it, it's really small now, but I can tell it's the wrong stuff. And so I think they seeded too quickly. It was more than likely they approached it what was best for their business. Mm-hmm. You know, get the seed put in the ground, get the customer thinks the it's going well. But I think what would have been better for the customer and produced a better planting was to be more patient, not worry about the paycheck so quick. And I would have delayed my seeding, took more time with the seed bed prep, because I can almost forecast already what it's going to look like. And it's what it's going to look like is what a lot of people have already seen when wildflowers have been planted, because a lot of time the seeding is rushed and there's not proper seed bed prep. So that's definitely the biggest difference I saw. more likely they didn't put down a lot of annuals. There was probably mostly perennials. I would hope, based on it was seeded in November, I would want some annuals in there to provide some cover that first year for perennial establishment as a cover crop. Otherwise, I see what I see there now. What's going to be their cover crop is a lot of weeds, broadleaf weeds, that are going to throw a lot of seed back into that planting next fall, and it's just setting them up for disaster 2 to 3 years down the road. I mean, it's classic, to be honest with you.
Okay. No, that's good, and it just shows that there is, again, a lot of sophistication and knowledge and experience that goes into this, and there's essentially a good way to do it. Maybe not, there's not always the perfect way, but there's a generally a good way to do it, and some processes are better than others, which is good to know. And people need to be conscious of that if they're suggesting, you know, or thinking through this in the idea of, well, I've got a no-till drill, right? I just said that. I've got a no-till drill. That's going to be easier for me with my sod situation.
Absolutely.
And you just said Absolutely. To me, maybe that's not the best option. And, you know, I certainly didn't buy a drill just to put in a pollinator planting, but it's at my, you know, disposal at that point. So it's thinking through some of these different issues. All right, I've got a couple more questions for you because I do follow you on social media and I watch your videos constantly and they're great. It's great seeing you make some of the improvements you're making to your new piece. But I notice a lot of propagation going on in your nursery and you're dipping root hormone on, it looks like, cuttings, and I'm kind of interested, what do you got going on back there in that nursery of yours? It looks like you're doing a lot of plant propagation, and I'm sure you have a lot of nursery stock there that you're invigorating for your next, you know, clients, but just kind of go Absolutely. Through some of the things that you're working on.
Yep. Spring's a super busy time, to be preparing plants for plantings later this summer. One reason why I have the nursery is because for my customer plantings, there's certain plants and flowers, different varieties of trees and whatnot, but mostly on the flower side that it takes 3 years. If you're trying to establish that from seed, the customer may not see those plants for 3 years. To me, that's 100% unacceptable. Things like milkweed, cardinal flower, you know, there's really nice perennials that the customer wants to see year one. And so I like to start those in the nursery and then transplant those into, you know, at the time of seeding or later on in the planting's life, I'll transplant in those, what I call them, specialty varieties. So that way the customer can see them right away. And plus, they're going to add additional seed into the planting that first year, just like everything else is putting seed back into the planting. And that's just going to help spread it faster. And so that's one reason why I have the nursery. It also helps reduce my business costs doing cuttings. You know, cuttings are a great way to establish certain varieties. It's quick. It's easy. If you have a small amount of stock on your property, and you can go in this time of year, grab those cuttings, and you can expand that at a huge rate. And it's just a great, cheap method to get more plants. I'll go out this time of year and dig up plants, you know, divide plants, and really potting them up in the nursery, having them on the ready to implement into projects and different plans on demand. And so it's nice to have that nursery stock there. And spring's always real busy trying to get stuff ready. Raspberries, fruit trees, flowers. And I'll start plants in the fall as well, biennials. So foxglove and different things like that. I'll start them in the fall. That way they're there in the spring to get right into the, you know, blooms that first season when they're in the customer's planting.
Yeah, awesome. And you use, I think, a rooting hormone. It's white.
I do.
It's white.
You know, there's lots of different rooting hormones out there. I just order a powder hormone off, you know, Amazon or whatever. They sell it at Walmart. I don't think you can really go wrong. And I'm not saying it's even 100% necessary. I think it does. Some people like to use the liquid. Some people use powder. you know, it is what it is. Use whatever you want. I don't think it really matters that much. But if you're going to do the work, why not throw a little extra, a few cents per stem at it and do a dip before you do a jab? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I want to bring up another concept for folks. I know this is a technique that I've seen quite often, and I've seen it in nature. It happens naturally. I've seen it with milkweed. Some of the briars that are in my particular area is a concept called tip layering. And I'm assuming that it's something that you do often, at least in certain instances, not just these root cuttings, but do you do any tip layering with some of the berry bushes, et cetera, on you know, in your particular nursery or in the adjacent areas that you're doing any work?
No, I can't even tell you what tip layering is, to be honest.
Okay, so I know something.
School me on it your listeners.
No, I'm not schooling anybody on this. This is something I saw years ago. In fact, the guy who listens to this podcast brought this up about a year ago and said, hey, I got this nursery situation or I'm propagating blackberry plants across my property. And why I realized this was when I was a kid. So when we were kids, we used to go out to, you know, my cousins who are just born and raised in the country. We used to go out and pick blackberries and we used to get sick in the summer times. We'd eat so much blackberries. Well, what we found was, you know, these blackberries would actually propagate themselves, not through seed, but they would get knocked down. A tree would fall on them. And all of a sudden that particular tip, it's inserted itself into the ground, and basically it created from that stem a rooted, and it created another plant. And so
absolutely,
and that tip layering concept, for anybody who's trying to propagate, if you don't have blackberry, raspberry, you could do it with red osier dogwood, some of the shrub species it works well with. And so you actually bend over that plant, you can put a stone on it, you can just dig it, you can put hooks on it, piece of wood, what have you, and it'll create another plant, it will root, and that's called tip layering. And I've seen that many. And it's really a simple concept. It works really well for propagation. So if people want to save money, it's a great way, you know, from these cutting options, you can take, you know, again, you bend over a raspberry or blackberry branch, stick it in the ground, and next thing you know, you're building hedgerows out of it. You can propagate hedgerows out of this. I've seen this done in certain instances in garden areas. And so I just, you know, I'm throwing that up as a concept. If you've not heard of that, just Google it. There'll be some good examples online to show you how to do that. Very simple, though. Doesn't cost you anything. You know, it's a free option.
Yeah, I believe. I didn't know that's what it was called, I guess. And tip layering makes no sense to me. Maybe tip burying.
Okay.
But yeah, I was digging up raspberry plants that same way. I just jabbed the stems in the ground that were at the, you know, the end of the cane. And by the next season, they had already rooted. And really, you don't even have to wait that long on raspberry plants. They will root very quickly. You can do it on apple trees as well. Bend it over into the ground with some weight, and yeah, it'll definitely start taking root. Or you can take the soil up to the branch as well. I'm sure you've seen it.
Yeah.
Where you use a plastic bag, or they sell a cup that goes around the branch with some soil in it. Those are much more successful methods. It takes much more time, but they're much more successful than traditional propagation with cuttings. You're almost on the, you know, the tip bearing method. You're almost 100% successful on that. It just takes a lot longer and much more time to get it done. But yeah, absolutely a great way to do it. It's the way I'm expanding my black raspberries into the new property. Bought a new place. It has no raspberries on it. And so we're bringing them in heavy. And that's how I'm starting it from the stock I have at my own house.
Well, there you go. I mean, and again, a free way for folks to integrate different varieties of plants across your property that doesn't really cost you anything, as long as you have the mother plant there present,
right,
et cetera.
Absolutely.
So great now, little simple technique.
Yep. One thing I will suggest for you and your listeners, when you're putting cuttings in, I've done a lot of cuttings, and the ones that were the most successful is when I use some type of weed barrier and put the cutting through it. because, you know, when you're out there and you're just, you know, putting them into the wild, in a nursery, you can root a cutting in a pot, you know, you can take care of it. But when you're putting it out in the wild and it's competing against other stuff that already has roots, it's real tough on it. And so if you can use some type of barrier, I like to use cardboard. You can use the black, you know, fabric barrier. But if you can at least get it through one season with some type of weed protection, and if you can treat the ground, you know, kind of kill it and spray it first, you're going to have more successful cuttings. Now, that might slow you down. So certainly in some areas I would use some protection, and then in other areas I would, for the sake of speed, I would just gamble and jam in a bunch of cuttings, you know what I mean?
Yeah
I think to guarantee yourself some success.
I've lost a lot of plantings, like people flag them or put a stake by them. I've lost so many plantings that way. If they're not tubed, or again mulch or stoned, or in your example putting out lumite or road fabric, you start to lose those in the landscape. Like tomorrow, in the middle of this rainstorm, I'm going to be planting about 1,000 willows. I'm creating another hedgerow in a field. And, you know, I'm putting down the material that we're talking about, the road fabric or whatever you want to call it. And it basically does an excellent job. The one thing I found over the years, I did my first willow planting in 2007. Okay, so it's been, you know, whatever, 18 years ago, whatever the number is, 16, 18 years ago. And what I learned over time, and I've done multiple projects with willow plantings, and I've created these hedgerow systems. It's been a whole part of my layering system when I'm doing like layering design and properties. And what I've realized over time is that material, depending like the thickness of it, you know, how robust it is, you don't necessarily want like a 5 ounce or an 8 ounce, very thick fabric with a backing material. You want it to break down because it chokes out your plant. So if you are using, like I got a welder down the road. He created like a little, that looks like a pogo stick, and basically just rebar. And I shove it in the ground. I step on it, I shove it in the ground. And I create that opportunity for me to put a rooted cutting or a cutting in the ground. And, you know, essentially allows me to just easily get that in the ground without disturbing that cut plant. And what I found in a quick period of time, if there's an area where there's really a lot of moisture, they really swell really quickly. So you have to cut the lumite or the road fabric in a shape where you don't girdle the plant. I've seen it kill plants. So you just got to be on top of, you know, just kind of the growth rate of those plants. What are you using to cut open, you know, the fabric, particularly if you're planting like spruce trees. I mean, I see that all the time where somebody's planting spruce trees through road fabric and eventually gets choked out by the road fabric because, you know, they bought a really kind of a dense, you know, heavy, you know, black material that doesn't break down at a quick rate. And again, it's just things to think about when you're putting, that's much different than putting down road fabric, you know, to support, you know, trails or road systems that you're putting in. You don't want necessarily something that is extremely robust that's going to last 15 years. You want something that's going to degrade after 3 to 4 years and is not choking out the plant. So just a small suggestion there, some of my experience. All right, I want to talk about your property, and that's the whole reason we're on this phone call. We're 27 minutes in and we haven't got to the gist of what we want to talk about. So you bought this parcel. I don't want to get into the particulars of, you know, who you bought it with, how it transacted, all that kind of stuff. But I want to get into some of the difficulties, because this isn't your typical hunting property. The way I looked at it, there's some open land, you've got some wetland, you know, and I'm not saying it's not a good hunting property, because it's going to be a good hunting property, but I want to kind of dive into your plan. I think we're going to go through your plan at a later date, but some of the things, the trials and tribulations, things that you're working through. I think you had NRCS involved, so I want to talk a little bit about, you know, just your strategy surrounding this particular property. Give us some details on the property and information behind it.
Oh yeah. Real excited about the new place. At my homestead where I live, I've got 35 acres. I've had that, I think we're going on 17 years now, something like that. It's really mature, you know, in the plan. And it's always nice when you can start out from scratch from somewhere and build something fresh and take what you learned and apply it to something new. And sure, I'm doing that for customers. But there's always a customer influence there. So to get a new property, especially one like this, that's that I can start from scratch, and it's my property. I'm super excited about it. But yes, it's in WRP program. The total property is 97 acres. And, you know, that's a large chunk. And I know land prices the way they are today, and they vary across location. But for me to purchase 97 acres straight out, I would not be able to do that. But basically teamed up with a few other guys, and we were able to pull together and purchase this property strictly for wildlife. Because it's locked up in the WRP program, we did get, you know, a decent deal on it compared to just traditional land prices. There's certainly restrictions there, but if you're wildlife habitat minded and that is what you're after, it's excellent way to access and get affordable property if that's what your goal is anyways.
Travis, just real quick, WRP, Wetland Reserve Program, I'm assuming?
Yep, okay. Wetland Reserve Program, right. Yep. And many times these will be locked up in perpetuality, and there's no payment on them. The original owner likely got the payment, and, you know, the deed and the regulations transfer with title, so there's no benefit except for the reduced purchase price, and, you know, knowing that nobody's going to build on it or anything like that. Which is great. And that's what we wanted anyways, was for wildlife habitat. So certain restrictions about certain native plants and timing of activities and, you know, the amount of food plots you can put in and things like that. But, you know, I got my personal property to do what I want to with. So I didn't mind the additional regulations of the new piece. It's a fairly young piece. So the tree planting was only 7 years old. They did it in a 2-year staggered planting. It's 30 acres of water and 60 acres of basically ground. Of the 60 acres of dry ground, half of it was put into an upland mix for upland birds, which is rare for Indiana. I mean, at least my area, we definitely don't have upland habitat. And I've raised pheasants, released pheasants, super excited about having some upland habitat. 30 acres is a nice sized chunk. And then the other 30 acres was planted into row tree planting. Really a great selection of trees they put in. A lot of different oaks, different pine trees. And, you know, they're 7 years old, so they're in the prime time right now as far as cover. Great time to have the property. The only downside is it wasn't exactly maintained how I would have probably approached it. There's a lot of cottonwoods coming in, really bad cottonwoods, and the cottonwoods outcompete your oaks. And so it was already starting to show, you know, the invasion of the cottonwoods. Those were not planted as part of the program. That was just, you know, voluntary cottonwoods coming in, but they definitely were not addressed. So that was one of the first things on the list, was, planning to come in and address cottonwood right away. Cattails are an issue on the place. So cattails were not addressed at all. And, you know, when we're looking at and creating the plan, we need to create a plan that's within the limitations of the WRP program. And so that required a meeting with the NRCS office. And, you know, we talked about what our goals were, you know, the regulations and their goals, cost share options. And it really went really well. The guy was great to work with. He appreciated that, you know, we wanted to come in and deal with some of the habitat issues. A lot of the grass plantings that were put in 7 years ago, they really deteriorated. The maintenance program maybe wasn't kept up as much. It is up to the landowner to do the maintenance. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I guess it's how aggressive does the landowner want to be in the upkeep and the periodic disturbance. So we're really, the property's got a lot of potential, and we're the right people to turn it around, no doubt about that. But it's going to take some time. So we're starting off now. We've already started to get into it, planting additional trees, bringing in fruit trees, raspberries. We've started dealing with cottonwoods. Mowing out food plots. So there was no food plot program on the place. And so we, you know, are ready to start implementing food plots. Year one, right out of the gate, we'll be getting plots in. adding additional trees, dealing with cottonwood and cattails. And if we get through that in year one, I'll be pretty satisfied. 97 acres, we're not going to hit all 97 for cottonwood control. That'll be like a three-year initiative where we'll identify sections and kind of progress through it based on a priority of need. So I think in 3 or 4 years, we can really have this place clicking. Now, I've been running trail cameras there.
Okay.
And so, you know, coming into the place, the variety of species is great. I mean, it's got pheasants, quail, lots of woodcock, ducks, geese. There's obviously deer. It just has every species that really Indiana has to offer, I believe, in this piece. But I wasn't sure about the quantity on the deer. So we started running some cameras. We took possession of the hunting rights last October. We did not hunt it at all for deer. We did some waterfowl hunting, but it was more about observation and learning the property. All us, the owners, we have our own personal properties to hunt. So this, we just left it lay. Did a lot of observation, didn't start running cameras until about December. And to be honest with you, I was 100% disappointed. There's been times on the camera where I'll go 2 weeks and not get a picture of a deer. There's deer sign. We found lots of rubs and stuff like that. But, you know, I was just been flabbergasted by the lack of deer frequency on the cameras. And I've moved the cameras around, put them in good locations. Part of the reason why I think it differs so much from what I see on a developed property, and this is true for my customers as well, is that when you get the program implemented of a food plot program with secure bedding and, you know, sanctuary, it creates a more predictable pattern of movement across your property. And, you know, you can take advantage of that if you're hunting it or for your recreation, and for trail cameras and things like that. I mean, my personal property, a day doesn't go by where you don't get a picture of a deer. But that's 15 years in, you know, on a program. So I'm curious to see how that changes from year one to year two. Even with the food plots and some of the initial improvements, will we see those trail camera observations increase? I can't wait to find out, but I think it definitely will. Some nice bucks over there. We had some 3.5-year-olds that survived the firearm season. Mm-hmm. Nothing great. But we've got a stock to work with, so we're excited about it.
Let's get into some of the application side of this. And I want to stay away from food plots. We can talk about fruit trees, but you talked a little bit about cottonwood eradication or minimization on the landscape. Let's go into some of the practices and why and the related benefit. Cottonwoods are there. There's obviously, you know, resident trees. I talked about this in another podcast where I was working on a property where there was beaver dams. And then eventually what happens is beavers eliminate all the suitable food in their area and then they eventually abandon the site unless they're trapped out or killed, what have you. And then as those areas slowly disintegrate, it creates this wonderful habitat. And it's funny at times, you know, you use animals as resources. I mean, we're not using them as resources, but they become resources. They deteriorate an area and it's very similar to areas getting burned off. You know, some of these African plain areas that eventually, you know, catch fire, and similar to what happens in the United States. And then eventually that regeneration opportunity becomes to light and you get plants and different animals. You know, you get rough grouse and blackbirds and white-tailed deer. They benefit from these particular areas. And in those instances is usually like kind of a metal habitat with maybe some fens, some bogs, you know, just variety. And I think some of the trick here is creating variety, and you'll be amazed at the water-loving plants. Viburnums come to mind. They're typically on the margins of those areas, those kind of emergent wetlands. They become just great resources for the animals. So I'm kind of wondering some tactics that you're employing, you know, in guidance with your wetland reserve program that are going to be influential to increasing deer numbers or deer interest around these wetter areas? Some tactics that you have, because I'm kind of interested in your strategy. And I know you do some duck hunting, so we could probably hit on that too.
Yep, absolutely. So a portion of the NRCS's office, their interest is protecting the taxpayers' investment. When they came in initially and established the place, the taxpayer is helping to fund that. And so they certainly don't want you in there cutting and removing the trees that they planted per that contract. So when we were designing the plan, we definitely avoided some of those conflicts. But Cottonwood, certainly they were all about that, how we're dealing with them. And there's a range in size on these cottonwoods. Some of them obviously started right away, so they're 7 years old. They might be 4 to 5, 6 inches in diameter. And then there's smaller ones, an inch diameter. We're going to handle them a couple different ways. On the larger ones, we're coming through and cutting them off flush with the ground and then treating them with Tordon RTU around the base. So we try to limit regrowth. On the smaller ones, we're not using a chainsaw, basically going through. We'll either do a basal bark treatment on those, or we will use clippers and clip them and then dab them with Tordon where the cut is. Using a bush hog when there's trees, and I think you got to be real careful of that. I've definitely made the mistake in the past that if you come in with a skid loader bush hog or, a tractor bush hog, and you create a lot of spears that later are going to be a tractor tire nightmare. And so, really when we're coming in and trying to do that tree control, especially in grasses, areas that we want to have grasses and may potentially be driving over later, we try to cut everything flush. I've popped my own tire on the situation that I created myself, and so it's real frustrating. We want to avoid that in this case. In the upland areas, the reason why they're having a lot of that has been degraded is because it wasn't set up to be controlled by fire. They didn't put in fire breaks and different things on the initial design that I think would have, mitigated a lot of what I'm going to be dealing with here shortly. So in the initial design, if they would have built in those fire breaks, it would be much easier to maintain. Now, fire is basically not an option for this place unless we go in and install those fire breaks. It's a lot harder to do now because it's 7 years old. If it would have been done at the onset, chances are, going out and throwing a match to it is much easier than having to go through and manually pick out species. The good thing is there's not a lot of autumn olive or honeysuckle, which that's one thing that impressed me about the place, is because that is rampant across northern Indiana. It's one of the couple of the problem species, but this place doesn't have much of that. And it's mostly cottonwoods, and cottonwoods are pretty easy to deal with. They're not real shrubby, not a lot of stems. On some of the other stuff, we'll just bite the bullet and use shears and cut those off and treat them. And then years down the road, we'll be able to just maintain it with bush hogging. And, they were okay with doing some disturbance and some regeneration. If you're not going in there and disturbing that soil periodically, it's going to get stale. And so they were all about starting that regeneration over again. We're excited about it as well. I think it's going to be great for the upland birds that are currently there. On the cattail side, and, what they're allowing us to do there, cattails in a wetland are super important. And this is a pre-emergent wetland. I mean, when you look at it, that's what it is. And so we're not looking to change it into something else. We've got to accept the place for what it is. That's one thing about the ducks and geese last fall. We noted that once we got the temperatures got, down below freezing, we started getting some heavy frost, the ducks and geese really moved off the place. They were still there. There was still some activity, but it was much higher prior to the colder temperatures. I got to believe food was a part of that, that the cattails are limiting the waterfowl's access to the seed bearing plants on the shore. There might be 20 to 30 foot thick cattails from the water to the seed bearing plants. And so once the invertebrate feed goes down, because of the cooler temperatures, the ducks are moving off. they're feeding in the grain fields and waters where they can access the seed bearing plants that they want to get to. And so we felt like we needed to improve that situation if we wanted to hold more ducks in the fall, but still maintain the integrity of the pre-emergent, you know, and the wetland that it is. And so what we negotiated was the cattails are critical really for filtering runoff into the wetland.
Yep.
And so what we proposed to them was we would leave cattails anywhere where the wetland was close to ag type runoff, you know, where there wasn't a strong buffer zone of either native grasses or some other type of stuff that would add that filtration. We would leave those cattails undisturbed, but on the inside edge, and mostly on the, it's on the inside edge where the WRP upland planting is, they're allowing us to remove cattails from some sections, 50 to 70 yards long, in a few spots around the edges. And then we're going to be able to come in there and plant some, you know, natives and things that are the seed bearing plants that we want for the ducks.
What can you give some examples of those, Travis? Just some of
nut sage, smartweed. Some of it we're hoping that we can just do some disturbance of the soil and create those, the native, you know, moist soil plants that are already there. I can appreciate foxtail, any of your grasses with, you know, sprangle top that has nice seed heads. That's what we're looking for. Anything's going to be better than the cattails that are there now. Yeah. And so we know this is going to be probably a 2 to 3 year type transition. This year is going to be all about getting cattails under control. You know, we're going to need to use some herbicide applications. We're cutting to kind of expose the growth that's going to be coming on here pretty soon. And then we'll be using some herbicide. And we're hoping to knock them back heavy this year and then be able to really look at, you know, establishment next year. It's going to be an ongoing battle. And to be honest with you, if we don't have success in these first 3 to 5 years, we'll kind of reevaluate our efforts and see if it's worth the effort that we're putting into it. And then, you know, kind of go from there. That's our plan anyways.
Is there any shrub wetlands adjacent or in that region of your wetland region?
So, you know, I like to call the area that I'm in, it's really a duck desert. If you go 40 minutes north, you start to get into a lot more lakes and wetlands, and the more north you go from where I'm at, the better you are. And if you can get close to a good roost, a good roosting lake, you know, you can be in the action. And so there's a couple large reservoirs in the area that can work as migrating, you know, roost for flocks. Unfortunately, the closest what I would call roost lake to this wetland, of course, we got 30 acres of water, so we do function as somewhat of a roost. But when you're talking large lakes, it's about 5 miles away. And so we're still catching some traffic from that lake. But for the most part, you know, it's not in a real great zone. There is a couple other wetlands within a 3 mile, you know, kind of distance from where we're at. And so we actually work on one of them. It's owned by a customer. And so when you can get multiple people in an area like that working together as far as disturbance, you know, hunting pressure, you know, using the roost as a roost, I think the area is going to see more success overall. So we're looking forward to working with the other people in the area.
That's great. So let's, if we could switch it back to deer for a second, and you talked about removing cottonwood, in a lot of areas around here, cottonwood are a desired browse species at a certain age. That's a younger age, so to speak. But are you looking at replacement plants, like things like alder come to mind, willows, dogwoods, maybe planting some red maples in those areas? Like, what are the species? Are there any, a part of your contract, are there any replantings or planting options that are, you know, wildlife focused, anything around those, or what's being done in those particular areas?
Yep. So we're primarily focused on native trees.
Okay.
One of the great things about the property is chock full of dogwood. Oh, cool. I mean, just dogwood everywhere, which is fantastic. It's 5 years old, great browse, great height. I don't have to worry about putting any dogwood in there. It's got a ton of oaks. It's got a lot of really good stuff. But what it's missing to me is the soft mast. No fruit trees, no purposely planted apple trees. The original owner had a home on the property, and he planted all his fruit trees in his yard up at his house. And so now, you know, what we own is devoid of fruit trees. So yeah. That's the big focus right out of the gate is apple trees, persimmons, elderberry, choke cherry, American plum. Those are all species that we're putting in, you know, this spring. We're adding some white pine as well, because the original people that put the planting in, they laid the trees out how they wanted to lay them out. It's not necessarily how we want them for the future of screening and hunting access. And so we're putting in some additional white pines, which will be good because they'll be younger than the rest of the stuff. Which,
excellent.
We'd like that, you know, that staggered planting. We're adding some oaks, but not very many. Bald cypress, putting some bald cypress in this year. So, you know, a whole host of varieties, but focused on the soft mast because that's what the property's lacking. You got to really look at the property and say, what is it lacking and what do I need to do right away, straight out of the gate to get it, you know, get it improved. Because it takes a few years before those soft mast trees are really going to start paying off. So we want to get those in right away. So that's first priority.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. Just in regards to, and you talked about a few things that I thought were kind of interesting, purifying the water based from the runout of the agriculture areas. There's other things to worry about, erosion control in certain instances where flooding happens in wetland areas. Is there, what's feeding this wetland? I'm kind of interested.
Yep. So supposedly they broke 5 tiles. The property before, the 30 acres that's underwater now, it would hold water seasonably prior. The other 60 acres was farmed. And so as part of the contract, they had to give up 2 acres of agricultural ground for every 1 acre of the swamp ground that was going to go into the program. But it would dry out. The owner said they had seen it completely dry before. They've seen deer standing out in the middle of it, but they crushed the tiles. They built a trickle spillway, basically has a 200-yard kind of natural spillway that controls the water. It does not have an adjustable water level. It's kind of a fixed water level.
Yep.
And then it has a trickle drain on the end of it. You know, that's going to be part of the learning as well, watching the water fluctuations and, you know, and just seeing how that goes. When you live there, you know, you get to see it. It's going to take us a few years to figure it out. And so we'll just be monitoring that.
I have found over the years in properties like this where there is a fluctuation, just and there, it's environmentally driven, you know, because it's not a constant source of water. The wildlife activity, particularly on those margins, white-tailed deer specifically, absolutely are driven to those locations big time. And it's funny, you kind of just mentioned that just an example there of a deer being, you know, standing in that particular area, but absolutely driven. And a lot of it has to do to not just the plant rich material, but, you know, the water rich material. It's the mineral content that's related in those margins. That's why deer are very focused on wet meadow areas. A lot of people don't pay attention to wet meadows. They kind of write them off as garbage. And they're actually highly valued, particularly certain times seasonality. And I think that people don't put an emphasis on these things because they think strictly upland. And they don't recognize the value of a wetland resource, vernal pools, you know, any of those type of areas that are on your properties. And they can be, again, highly valued and utilized by our beloved white-tailed deer. So just adding to your conversation, Travis.
Absolutely. I mean, anytime you can have a property with a water resource on it, it just, the value to wildlife just increases exponentially. One thing interesting about this piece, and I haven't touched on it yet, but we're going to find out, all of us together, is part of the reason why the owner was selling it was because of a massive solar project that is going in next to the property. And when I say massive, we're talking about 2,000 acres, I believe it is, that's planned to go to solar panels. It's almost a 3-mile stretch, you know, where they're going to be putting in panels, high fences. It's really going to change the landscape around this place. And so they have not started construction on that solar farm yet. Supposedly it's scheduled for, to start in like 2025 possibly. So maybe next year. It depends on who you talk to. It's a done deal. And you know, there's impacts there, depending on what they put in underneath those solar panels and how they manage that. It could be great for ground nesting birds. There could be a lot of positive impacts of that. It also could be detrimental, depending on how they handle it. We know it's going to change deer movement. All the fences, there's no way that's not going to have an impact on the deer movement in the area. And so we're anticipating whatever we're seeing now, when they start that solar project, that things are going to change for us some. And so we're kind of counting on that. We knew that going in, that there was a risk there. It's not right directly next to it. At no time does it get any closer than a half mile. And so there's still some distance away from us and the solar farm, but still to the, especially deer, they travel more than a half mile. So it's going to have an effect on the deer movement in the area.
Absolutely.
We're hoping it's going to funnel more deer to us. We're thinking it's going to take some hunting pressure out of play, which is a great thing. We think it's going to funnel some movement to us. We're kind of curious on the waterfowl. You know, if you read studies, they say the birds can confuse the panels for water and, you know, dive bomb. But we're really interested to see the difference. They also say the solar farm can create a landmark for migrating birds. And so we may find that it attracts birds to us. So we're really curious to see how that works out. It'll be interesting to watch it unfold, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And some of the things you just mentioned there at the end are pretty cool. So I think our next go around, we're actually going to break down portions of the property and talk a little bit about, you know, any limitations, you know, through your wetland reserve program approach. We got into some of the details and just enhancement. We're gonna break down a section. I think that's what we talked about doing next. Break down a section and go through it. Hopefully we have some imagery associated with that. I think we'll take a smaller section and just kind of go into the details. Let's look at the plants that are present. Let's explain the enhancement that was done prior, you know, the failures behind that, the changes that you're making, the ultimate goals and objectives, and just kind of focus on how to take a small area and make it, you know, what you believe is more productive than it currently is. And then, you know, maybe we could touch on some of the wetland areas. I'm starting to get involved in more wetland projects, and I'm really finding a lot of opportunity for people to have better hunting, making small changes to wetland areas. Again, assuming you're not disturbing, you know, any, you know, particular restrictions that you have in your locality based on the type of wetland that you have. But really starting to diagnose, you know, minor and major things that you can do in these areas, and really just to removing some of the cattails that you talked about earlier. I just listened to a really cool podcast from a scientist that explained the hibernized cattails across the landscape and how they can't discern what was natural and native and not native anymore, and how there's just this litany of discussion around this topic. And really just, you know, they've made these hibernized cattails are becoming way more progressive, and how they're dealing with that in the landscape. That's the same concept where people are dealing with the Phragmites in my particular area. And again, these hybridization, you know, situations just create this litany of issues that we're all having to deal with as landowners and land stewards. So it's just another thing to deal with. So I think that's the future conversation. That's what we've hit on. So I think we're going to have you on again. We're going to talk about more along this lines or any other topics that you want to bring up and just kind of learn a little bit more about your tactics and approach. Cause obviously you're setting up deer hunting properties, you know, just that's part of the business. So we've got to recognize your experience there as well. So, anything else from you?
No, I just say if your listeners want to follow along, you know, jump over on Instagram, give us a follow, Creative Habitat. You know, I'll be posting what's going on, what we're doing, as well as customer projects. Got a lot of exciting things going on this year. Not just my own personal property, but customers are doing great things. And we're getting ramped up, man. I just started using a herbicide last few days. You know, spring's getting right. Things are going to start rolling, and it's go time, baby.
Yep.
You know, I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, jump on over to Instagram, give us a follow, and you can see what's happening. We also sell seed, so seed coffers are full. Jump over to the website there, and you can order some seed, and you get our planting tips that come with the seed. And I'll tell you right now, the planting tips are just as valuable as the seed is. So if you're looking to plant some flowers, it's well worth it.
Well, I'll tell you, for my next pollinator planting, I will stop being so ignorant and thinking that I'm capable to do everything that I currently do, and reference an expert like yourself that actually does this in the field. And I'll probably go to your blends next. So when I stop being so ignorant, I'll have to give you a call. I know that I have had clients use you. So I'm very happy that people are making that connection, because I think this is a great resource for people. I think, you know, you can't be so myopic and just focus on, you know, switchgrass or conifer plantings or oak plantings. I mean, you've really got to think holistically. You've got to think, you know, from the grass, you know, to really these canopy trees, the variation in between is really important. And introducing some plants that you may like in your yard, or you want adjacent to, let's say, a beehive that you have, or maybe it's a natural hive that's in your particular area. Just thinking about having some diversity in the landscapes, probably the best thing you can do. Natural plants are ideal. But, you know, developing kind of these blends that you already have, it makes it a lot simpler. And don't try to go out there and create it yourself and be like me, you know, be a little smarter than that. So, Travis, appreciate your time. Definitely follow your content online. I love watching your stuff every day. It kind of brightens my day. There's tons of cool stuff. And we learned a new word today, tip layering. So,
good to us. Appreciate that, man. Yeah.
All right, man. Well, all right. More to come from us, and look forward to learning about your project and talking about it. So right, we'll talk to you in an upcoming podcast.
Yep, we'll see you.
All right, brother. See you, man.
All right, bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.